For Christmas, I hang some tinsel from my handlebars and put a silver star on the big hex nut that holds the headset to the front forks. Tony the Tiger thinks that's pretty funny. He stopped into my sick room this morning as I lay flat on my back on my grimy, sweaty futon, one arm outflung, hand resting on the twisted wreckage of my front wheel. He stood in the doorway, grinning from striped shirt to flaming red mustache, and barked, "Ha!" at me. Which is his prerogative, since this is his place I'm staying at, here in a decaying Rosedale mansion, gone to spectacular Adam's family ruin. This is where he took me in when I returned on my bike from the ghost town of Niagara Falls, where I'd built a nest of crap from the wax museums and snow globe stores, until the kitsch of it all squeezed my head too hard and I rode home to a Toronto utterly unlike the one I'd left behind. I'd been so stunned by it all that I totally missed the crater at Queen and Brock, barreling along at 40K, and I'd gone down like a preacher's daughter, smashing my poor knee and my poor bike to equally dismal fragments. "Ha!" I bark back at Tony the Tiger. "Happy Mary, dude. You too." Which it is, more or less, for us ragtags who live on Tony the Tiger's paternal instincts and jumbo survivalist sized boxes of cornflakes. And now it's the crack of noon, and my navel is thoroughly contemplated, and my adoring public awakes, so it's time to struggle down bravely and feed my face. I've got a robe. It used to be white and plush with a hood. The hood's still there, but the robe itself is the sweat mat gray of everything in Tony the Tiger's dominion. I pull it on and grope for my cane. I look down at the bruisy soccer ball where my knee used to be, and gingerly snap on the brace that Tony fabbed up for me out of foam and Velcro. Then it's time to stand up. "Frickin' Mother Jesus shit fuck!" I shout and drown out my knees' howls of protests. "You okay?" floats Tony's voice up the stairs. "Peachy keen!" I holler back and start my 22-year-old old fogey shuffle down the stairs. Step, drag. On the ground floor landing, someone's used aerosol glitter to silver the sandbags that we use to soak up bullets randomly fired into our door. It's a wonderful life. I check myself out in the mirror. I'm skinny and haunted and stubbly and gamey. Numb. There's a pair of size 9 Kodiaks and a puddle of melting slush and someone's dainty wet sock prints headed for the kitchen. Daisy Duke's home for the holidays. Off to the kitchen for me. And there she is, a vision of brave perseverance in the face of uncooperative climate. She's 5'6 average, not thin, not fat, average, eyes an average hazel, tits too, arms too, legs too, and skin the color of Toronto's winter, sun-deprived white with a polluted gray tinge. My angel of mercy. She leaps out of her chair and is under my arm supporting me before I know it. "Max's, hi," she says, drawing out the "hi" like an innuendo. "Daisy Duke as I live and breathe," I say, and she's got the same mix of sweat and fun smell coming off her hair as when she sat with me while I shouted and raved about my knee for a week after coming to Tony the Tiger's. She puts me down in her chair as gently as an air traffic controller. She gives my knee a look of professional displeasure as though it were swollen and ugly because it wanted to piss her off. "Looking down and out there, Maxes. You been to a doctor yet?" Tony the Tiger, sitting on the stove, head ducked under the exhaust hood, stuffs his face with caramel corn and snorts. "The boy won't go. I tell him to go, but he won't go. What to do?" I feel like I should be pissed at him for nagging me, but I can't work it up. Dad's gone, taken away with the other process heads on the mothership, which vanished as quickly as it had appeared. The riot started immediately. Process HQ at Young and Bloor was magnificently torched, followed by the worldwide franchises. Presumably, we'd been judged and found wanting. Only a matter of time now. So I can't get pissed at Tony for playing fatherly. I even kind of like it. And besides, now that hospitals are turf, I'm as likely to get cacked as cured, especially when they find out dear old Dad was the bull goose process head. Thanks, Pop. "That right? Won't take your medicine, Maxes. She can do this eye twinkle thing, turn it on and off at will, and when she does, it's like there's nothing average about her at all. I'm too pretty to take it in there." Daisy turns to Tony, and they do this leaders of the commune meaningful glance thing that makes me apeshit. "Maybe we could get a doc to come here," Daisy said at last. "And perform surgery in the kitchen," I say back. All the while, my knee is throbbing and poking out from under my robe. Daisy and Tony hang head and I feel bad. These two, if they can't help, they feel useless. "So how you been?" I ask Daisy, who has been AWOL for 3 weeks, looking for her folks in Kitchener-Waterloo, filled up with the holiday spirit. "Baby, it's cold outside. Took Highway 2 most of the way. The 407 was drive-by city. The heater on the Beetle quit about 10 minutes out of town, so I was driving with a toque and mittens and all my sweaters. But it was nice to see the folks, you know. Not fun, but nice." Nice. I hope they stuck a pole up Dad's ass and put him on top of the Xmas tree. It's good to be home. Not enough fun in Kitchener. I am positively fun hungry. She doesn't look it. She looks wiped up and wrung out, but hell, I'm pretty fun hungry too. "So what's on the Yuletide agenda, Tony?" I ask. "Thought we'd burn down the neighbors, have a cheery fire." Which is fine by me. The neighbors split 2 weeks before. Morons from Scarborough. Thought that down in Florida people would be warm and friendly. Hey, if they can't be bothered to watch the tacticals fighting it out in the tunnels underneath Disney World, it's none of my shit. "Sounds like a plan," I say. We wait until after 3, when everyone in the happy household has struggled home or out of bed. We're almost 20 when assembled, ranging from little tiny Tim to bulldog pawn shop Maggie, all of us unrecalcitrant snagged in the tangle of Tony's hypertrophied organizational skills. The kitchen at Tony's is big enough to prepare dinner for 40 guests. We barely fit as we struggle into our parkas and boots. I end up in a pair of insulated overalls with one leg slit to make room for my knee/soccer ball. If this was Dad and Mum, it'd be like we were gathered for a meeting, waiting for the chairman to give us the word. But that's not Tony's style. He waits until we're approaching ready, then starts moving towards the door, getting out the harness. Daisy Duke shoulders a kegger of foam and another full of kerosene, and Granville gets the fix bath. Tiny Tim gets the sack of marshmallows, and we trickle into the yard. It was a week and a half after Halloween when the vast cool intelligences from beyond the stars zapped away. The whole year since they'd arrived, the world had held its breath and tippy-toed around on best behave. When they split, it exhaled. The gust of that exhalation carried the stink of profound pissed-offedness with the processors, who'd acted the proper Nazi hall monitors until the bug-outs went away. I'd thrown a Molotov myself into the process center at the falls and shouted into the fire until I couldn't hear myself anymore. So now I'm a refugee on Xmas Eve, waiting for fearless leader to do something primordial and cathartic. Which he does, even if he starts off by taking the decidedly non-primordial step of foaming the side of our squat that faces the neighbors, then fixing it, Daisy Duke wanging away on the harness's seal with a rock to clear the ice. Once our place is fireproofed, Daisy Duke switches to Caro, and we cheer and clap as it laps over the neighbors, a two-story coach house. The Caro leaves shiny patches on the rime of frost that covers the place. My knee throbs, so I sit kneel against the telephone pole out front. The kids are getting overexcited, pitching rocks at the glass to make holes for the jet of Caro. Tony shuts down the stream, and I think for a minute that he's pissed he's going to take a piece out of someone, but instead he's calm and collected and asks people to sort out getting hoses, buckets, and chairs from the kitchen. Safety first, and I have to smile. The group hops to it, extruding volunteers through a non-obvious Brownian motion, and before long, all of Tony's gear is spread out on the lawn. Tony then crouches down and carves a shallow bowl out of the snow. He tips the foam keg in, then uses his gloves to sculpt out a depression. He slops fix bath on both, then fills his foam and snow bowl with the last of the Caro. "You all ready?" he says, like he thinks he's a showman. Most of us are cold and wish he'd just get it going, but Tony's the kind of guy you want to give a ragged cheer to. He digs the snow out from around the bowl and holds it like a discus. "Maestro, if you would," he says to Daisy Duke, who uses a long fireplace match to touch it off. The thing burns like a brazier, and Tony the Tiger frisbees it square into the middle of the porch. There's a tiny shuff, and then all of the Caro seems to catch at once, and the whole place is orange and warm as the summer. We pass around the marshmallows, and Tony's a frickin' genius. The flames lick and spit. The house kneels in slow, majestic stages. The back half collapses first, a cheapy addition that's 50 years younger than the rest of the place. The front porch follows in the aftershock, and it sends a constellation of embers skittering towards the marshmallow roasters, who beat at each other's coats until they're all extinguished. As the resident crip, I've weaseled my way into one of the kitchen chairs, and I've got it angled to face the heat. I sit close enough that my face feels like it's burning, and I turn it to the side and feel the delicious cool breeze. The flames are on the roof now, and I'm inside my own world watching them. They dance spacewards, and I feel a delicious thrill as I realize that the bugouts are not there, that the bugouts are not watching, that they took my parents and my problems and vanished. I'm broken from the reverie by Daisy Duke, who's got a ski mask on, mouth-rimmed and gummy marshmallow. She's got two more marshmallows and one three-fingered cyclist glove. Marshmallowy, I say. It's got that hard carboniferous skin and gooey inside that's almost hot enough to scald my tongue. I like it. Almost New Year's, she says. Yuh-huh. Gonna make any resolutions, she asks. You? Are you? Sure, she says, and honestly, I can't imagine what this perfectly balanced person could possibly have to resolve. You first, she said. Gonna get my knee fixed up. That's it? The rest I'll play by ear. Maybe find some process heads to hit. How about you? Get the plumbing upstairs working again. Foam the whole place. Cook one meal a week. Start teaching self-defense. Make sure your knee gets fixed up. And suddenly she seems like she's real old, even though she's only 25, only 3 years older than me. Oh yeah, that's real good. Got any other plans for next year, Max's? No, nothing special. I feel a twinge of freeloader's anxiety. Maybe try and get some money, help out around here? I don't know. You don't have to worry about that. Tony may run this place, but I'm the one who found it, and I say you can stay. I just don't want to see you... She swallows. You know, waste your life. No, Swetsky. I'm not even thinking as I slip into this line. I'll be just fine. Something'll come up. I'll figure out what I want to do. Don't worry about me. Unexpectedly, and out of the clear orange smoke, she hugs me and hisses in my ear fiercely. I do worry about you, Maxes. I do. Then Bunny nails her in the ear with a slush ball, and she dives into a flawless snap roll, scooping snow on the way for a counter-strike. Tony the Tiger's been standing beside me for a while, but I just noticed it now. He barks a trademarked "Ha!" at me. How's the knee? Big, ugly, and swollen. Yum, how's the brain? Ditto. Double yum. Got any New Year's resolutions, Tony? Trim my mustache. Put in a garden. Here where the neighbor's place was. Start benching in the morning. Work on my upper body. Foam the house. Open the rooms in the basement. Take in some more folks. Get a cam and start recording house meetings. Start an e-zine for connecting up squats. Some more things. You? Don't ask, I say, not wanting to humiliate myself again. He misunderstands me. Well, don't sweat it. If you make too many resolutions, you're trying, and that's what counts. Yuh-huh. It feels good to be overestimated for a change. Tony used to work in the customer service department at Eaton's Walmart, the big one at Dundas and Young where the Eaton Center used to be. They kept offering him promotions, and he kept turning them down. He wanted to stay there, acting as a guide through the maze of bureaucracy that you had to navigate to get a refund when you bought the dangerous, overpriced shit they sold. It shows. It's like he spent 30 years waiting for an opportunity to grab a megaphone and organize a disaster relief. The neighbors is not recognizable as a house anymore. Some people are singing carols. Then it gets silly, and they start singing dirty words. I join in when they launch into jingle bells, translated into process speak. I turn back into the fire and lose myself in the flickers, and I don't scream at all. Fuck you, Dad. Someone scrounged a foam mini keg of whiskey, and someone else has come up with some chewable vitamin C soaked in something up, and the house gets going. Those with working comms, who pays for their subscriptions, I wonder? Micropay for some tunage, and we split between the kitchen and the big old parlor, dancing and merry Xmasing late. About half an hour into it, Tony the Tiger comes in from the servant's door, his nose red. He's got the hose in one hand, given a glove frozen stiff from blowback. I'm next to the door, shivering, and he grins. Putting out the embers. I take his gloves and toque from him and add them to the drippy pile beside me. I've got a foam tumbler of whiskey, and I pass it to him. The night passes in the warmth of 20 sweaty, boozy, speedy bodies, and I hobble from pissoir to whiskey until the whiskey's gone and the pissoir is swimming from other people's misses, and then I settle into a corner of one of the ratty sofas in the parlor, dozing a little and smiling. Someone wakes me with a hard, whiskey-fumed kiss on the cheek. "How can you sleep on speed, Max's?" Daisy shrieks into my ear. I'm not used to seeing her cut so loose, but it suits her. That twinkle is on permastrobe, and she's down to a sports bra and cycling shorts. She bounces onto the next cushion. I pull my robe tighter. Just lucky that way. Speed hits me hard, then drops me like an anvil. My eyelids are like weights. She wriggles up to me, and even though she's totally whacked, she manages to be careful of my knee. Cautiously, I put my arm around her shoulders. She's clammy with sweat. "Your dad, he must have been some pain in the ass, huh?" She's babbling in an adrenalized tone, and the muscles under my hand are twitching. "Yeah, he sure was. I can't imagine it. I mean, we used to watch him on the tube and groan. When the bugouts got here and he told everyone he'd been invited to explain to them why they should admit humanity into the Galactic Federation, we all laughed our asses off. My sister, she's 30. She's ended up somewhere out west. We think maybe Winnipeg. She had a boyfriend in high school who ended up there." It takes her 4 more hours to wind down, and I think I must be picking up a contact high from her, because I'm not even a little bit tired. Eventually, she's lying with my head in her lap, with her head in my lap, and I can feel my robe slip underneath her, and I'm pretty sure my dick is hanging out underneath her hair, but none of it seems to matter. No matter how long we sit there, I don't get cramps in my back, none in my knee, and by the time we both doze away, I think I maybe am in love. I should have spent the night in bed. I woke up nearly 20 hours later, and my knee felt like it's broken into a million pieces, which it was. I wake with a yelp, catch my breath, yelp again, and Daisy is up and crouching beside me in a flash. Tony arrives a moment later, and they take me to bed. I spend New Year's there behind a wall of codeine, and Daisy dips her finger into a glass of fizzy fake champagne and touches it to my lips at midnight. I eat 4 codeine tabs before getting up, my usual dose. February is on us, as filthy and darky as the grime around the toilet bowl, but I accentuate the positive. By the time I make it downstairs, Tony's in full dervish, helping unload a freshly scrounged pallet of brown bread, lifted from the back of some bakery. He grins his trademark at me when I come into the kitchen and grin back. "Food," he says, tearing a heel off a loaf and tossing it my way. A half dozen of my housemates, new arrivals whose names I haven't picked up yet, are already sitting around in the kitchen, stuffing their faces. I reach into my robe pocket for my comm and shout, "Smile!" and snap a pict, then stash it in the dir that I'm using for working files for the e-zine. "What's the caption?" says Tony. "Man, oh manna," I say. I eat my heel of bread, then stump into the room that Daisy calls the butler's pantry, that I use for my office, and shut the door. Our e-zine, Sit Spin, went from occasional to daily when I took it over after New Year's, and I commandeered an office to work in. Apparently it's de rigueur cafe reading in Copenhagen. Whatever. The important things are, 1, I can spend the whole day in my office without once remembering to need to take a pill. 2, when I come out, Daisy is always the first one there, grabbing my comm and eating the ish with hungry eyes. I start to collect the day's issue, pasting in the pict of Tony and Daisy under the masthead.